All right, we're underway with session 63. We're in lesson 12, page 11.
Are we going to sing?
Sing Psalms 113.
We'll get there. We'll get there. All right, let's review a little bit of where we're going. We started last week dealing with Passover preparations, and we saw that a week or two before Passover, roads were repaired, wells were repaired, bridges were repaired, all kinds of physical repairs took place around Jerusalem to prepare for the massive crowds that would descend upon the city. The city normally estimated to have a population of 500,000. The population swelled to 2 million during the Passover season. So here is a crew of men getting ready for the crowds, getting the infrastructure ready. And also the tombs were whitewashed. Here a man is whitewashing a poor man's tomb. And the reason for the white paint on the rocks was to warn the visitors. And you can see the travelers at the top of the picture. Warn them that don't come and sit down on this rock and have lunch because you'll incur corpse uncleanness. This is a tomb. Stay away from me. So another preparation. Then slightly before Passover, those Jewish people that owned a bakery or something like that that was full of leaven, and they couldn't get rid of their leaven, would sell it to a trusted Gentile, and that's happening even today. They would sell it for a token price to a trusted Gentile who would then sell the leaven back to them, the bakery or whatever, at the end of Passover. And this was a legal contract. The trusted Gentile did own the bakery and didn't have to sell it back, but that's why you chose a trusted Gentile. A very legal contract, but it is actually a legal fiction, a way to get around the requirement not to own any Passover, any chametz, any leaven during Passover. The night before Passover, the families would inspect their homes for leaven. Papa would take a candle, a feather, and a wooden spoon. At least today we do this. He'll light the candle and inspect all the nooks and crannies of the home looking for leavened bread, something leavened. And Mama would very conveniently leave some bread in a corner where Papa and the kids would find it. Papa would then scoop the leavened material onto the wooden spoon, wrap it up in a cloth or a napkin, and dispose of it by burning it. And here I showed you a picture of all the leavened bread of this household being burned up. Rolls, bagels, burnt toast. If anyone likes their toast down twice, this is the way to do it. So all the leaven is burned up and removed. Then we saw that John and Peter were to prepare the Passover in the upper room. The traditional location of the upper room is here on the western hill, and it's probably the right location. We're not sure, but it seems to be a lot of the archaeology seems to point to that. Now, here is the house of the Last Supper, the exterior of it. You go inside it and you see a second floor room that is quite large. Although the architecture is recent, it is medieval, or I should say Crusader European arches there. That's a Crusader European style. And so while the location is probably accurate, the building itself is relatively new, biblically speaking. And this room was used as a mosque. It was also used as a church. And now it is a primary tourist attraction. So that's the upper room, very likely the place where Yeshua had the Last Supper. Directly below the upper room is David's tomb. Again, David is not buried here, but the Orthodox do revere this place for the memory of David. At Cenotaph, in the middle of the picture, there is a Crusader memorial to David. And the room is now a synagogue. It's divided in half. This woman would find herself on the men's side of the synagogue if she went there today. But that niche in the background is important because it helps with the architecture or the archaeology of the building. And archaeologists have concluded that this building is the very first church building. This is the Church of the Apostles. And a number of items lead them to that conclusion. First of all, you see the Crusader cenotaph of King David sitting on the present Arab floor, which sits on the Crusader floor, which sits on the Byzantine floor, which sits on the Roman period floor, which sits on the first century floor, And in between the Roman floor and the first century floor, there was found Judeo-Christian graffiti, Jewish Christian graffiti. So the Jewish Christians had written something or dropped something there that clearly identified the fact that Jewish believers in Jesus were occupying this site in the first century. And so it is believed it is the first church building. And another factor that leads archaeologists to believe that is the orientation of the building. Not due north. It's not oriented along the axis of the earth. Nor is it oriented toward the site of the temple, but it is oriented toward the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And again, in this map, not oriented due north. So the directions of the compass have nothing to do with the orientation. Not oriented toward the Holy of Holies of the temple, as a synagogue would be. So that is not the reason for this building, but it is oriented directly at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And so archaeologists conclude the Jewish Christians of the first century deliberately built their church building in that orientation, because that's very much a way Jewish people think. So there's your first church, the church that's the mother church to this one, and your church. Wherever you are in the world, this is the mother church, the first one. All right, John and Peter prepared the upper room for the Passover, something we're going to be doing next Monday and Tuesday as well. And then they went out and got their Passover lamb for their group, their family, and they went to the temple for the Passover sacrifice. And when they came to the temple, they were lined up in groups of 10 or 20 individuals. Here's Peter at the conveniently at the end of this line, so we can see what he's doing. And then at the sound of a trumpet blast, Peter, with his little knife, slit the jugular vein of the lamb that he had purchased, and the blood was caught by the priest in a mitzrach. Now, here is a mitzrach that the Temple Institute has constructed, not as a museum piece, but as a anticipated working piece, working instrument in the Third Temple. And you can see these at the Temple Institute when you go to Jerusalem and visit there. So the lamb's jugular vein was slit, the blood caught in the mitzrach, and then the mitzrach were handed down the line of priests, bucket brigade style, until they reached the base of the altar. At the base of the altar, the priests would pour the blood out, and then the mitzrach would be sent back up the line, bucket brigade style, for the next round of sacrifices. So it was a very efficient system. They had to sacrifice 250,000 lambs in the space of about 4 or 5 hours. So they needed to be very efficient. Yes?
You mentioned that Peter slit the lamb's throat.
Yes. Not the priest. Well, in many of the sacrifices, it is the priest on behalf of the offerer, but in Passover, the family does it. Okay, just as they did in just as we did in Egypt. In Egypt, the family sacrificed the lamb. So Peter did that job. Question?
Yeah, 250,000 lambs. That's mm-hmm. a lot of.
Yes.
I mean, what would they do with it?
They'd eat it. This is these lambs all become the main course for the Passover meal. Then they take it home to the family, yes.
Okay.
This is the 14th of Nisan. This is the family's individual Passover sacrifice. And each one of these representatives represent a family of 10 people or 20 people, something like that. All right, here is the mitzrach in operation. The priest on the left is dashing the blood against two sides of the altar, which was required for some sacrifices. But the priest in the middle is doing what he would do at Passover. He's pouring out the blood at the base of the altar. Now, 250,000 lambs were sacrificed. That is a lot of blood. And the blood would drain through pipes into the Kidron Valley, and the little stream at the bottom of the Kidron Valley would run red with blood. And the fact is illustrated nicely in this picture. We see the Levitical priests squeeging the blood to the drainage tubes, and you see they're working ankle deep in blood. Ankle deep in blood. Remember, don't have a romantic view of the temple. Okay? It was a smelly, dirty, It really wasn't a nice place, because sin is not nice. Part of the picture there is to point out to us how horrible sin is and what it takes to forgive it, the death of the Messiah. More valuable than 250 lambs a year, 250,000 lambs a year. All righty, so that brings us now to the middle of page 11. On page 11, they would sacrifice the lamb. And then point two, after the sacrifice, they would sing the Hallel, Psalms 113 to 118. And Psalm 118 is an especially strong messianic psalm because it contains the great messianic greeting that was sung to Jesus as he made the triumphal entry. Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. We have blessed you from the house of the Lord. This is the great messianic greeting. So very, very strong messianic psalm there. These psalms are recited today in the Passover Haggadah. And so some of you are going, what? What was that word he just issued? Haggadah, what is that? Well, the Haggadah is the book containing the 19 services of the Passover. And this is a very popular Haggadah. It's a paperback version by Rabbi Goldberg. You'll see it all over the place. You see, Rabbinic Judaism is a liturgical religion. That means everything has its set order. That's what the word Seder means. We're following the set order of the Passover, the set ritual of the Passover. So everybody has their copy of the Haggadah, and they open it up and read through it. Here's the interior of that Haggadah. And the very first ceremony is the recitation of the Kiddush, the first cup of wine that is consumed, and you see it in Hebrew on the right side and then in English on the left side. And when we celebrate Passover here next Tuesday, we'll have our own little Haggadah to go through as well. Here is, I think this is a medieval Haggadah. It's a codex form. You can see it's quite large, very nicely illustrated. It must have been very, very beautiful when it was brand new. Now, of course, you can see that it's a little bit time-worn. But it's been a tradition in the Jewish community for many, many, many centuries. All righty. So that's the Haggadah, the book that contains the 19 services of the Passover. Thirdly, the lamb would then be cleaned and skinned, etc., by the Levites. The entrails would be removed. And then fourthly, you can see the illustration at the bottom of page 11. The entrails and other parts would be brought up to the top of the altar where they would be burned. All right, now go to page 12. You'll see a couple more illustrations. Point 5 at the top of page 12 there, the lamb would then be taken home. And here's that illustration of the father and his son taking their lamb and the whole group of men leaving the temple, heading for their homes with their sacrificed lamb. And then it would be put into the oven and baked, roasted. I shouldn't say baked, roasted in preparation for the Passover meal that evening. So here Papa and his young son are getting the lamb ready. Number 6 on the top of page 13, other Passover items would be prepared as well. For example, the unleavened bread. Here's the matzah. This is machine-made matzah. Modern machine-made matzah. Say that fast 5 times, huh? Modern machine-made matzah. Okay. And it is nicely squared off. It is pierced, and it is striped according to rabbinic ordinance. The rabbis insisted that the matzah be pierced in order to prevent rising, leavening, and then they insisted that it be quickly baked, and that accounts for the striping. It's quickly baked. I think it's supposed to be 14 minutes from the time you mix the dough until the time it comes out of the oven.
Why does speed count?
To keep it from leavening. You don't want any leavening to occur.
Oh, okay.
That's why the speed. Yeah, so that's why it is pierced and striped. And here is handmade matzah, again, pierced and striped, as is often done in the ultra-Orthodox community. This is more like the matzah that Jesus would have used, handmade matzah, something like that. The wine would be prepared, and the bitter herb. Now, this is the bitter herb on the left side is horseradish mixed with beet juice, so it's red. Don't ask me why we put beet juice in it. I have not discovered that yet. You know, there's probably three or four different opinions regarding why. In the middle of the picture, you see romaine lettuce, which is bitter, and then a bit of horseradish root. So the bitter herb is a symbol of the bitterness of slavery. And there's some horseradish, more like what we will have Tuesday, to bring tears to your eyes to recall the bitter tears of the Egyptian slavery. Here is a Passover table all set for Passover. This would be a small family, and you can see Rabbi Goldberg's Passover Haggadah there ready for each of the participants to read through. And one more picture of a Passover table all ready to go, focusing on the matzah, the unleavened bread. To the left, the maror, the bitter herb. And over on the right is some parsley for the karpas. You have the wine glass and the candles and all that. So this family is all ready for Passover as well. Okay, so John and Peter labored most of the day getting and organizing all the items needed for the Passover. They had 13 men to prepare for. Now, when that evening came, the others and Jesus came into the upper room to participate in the celebration. So we're now at page 13 at the heading entitled The Room. So I'll refer to your drawing at the bottom of the page. I will be putting pieces of that drawing up on the overhead step by step as we build the features of the Passover room and the Passover table. All right, as they entered the upper room, they would have encountered the table prepared for them earlier in the day by John and Peter. So there would be a representation of the table. It would be a low eastern table, only about a foot off the ground, not like the tables we're using here, which are 3 feet off the ground. Okay, now it would be more like this. You see, these guys are down on the ground reclining, and the table is just 6 inches to a foot off the ground. So this is the kind of table, low eastern table. Now, getting back to our table, part of the table would be covered with a tablecloth. This would be the area where the guests would be reclining and the meal would be eaten. Part of the table would be uncovered. This would be the area for the miscellaneous items of the Passover, the bowls, the pitchers, the towels, or anything needed for the banquet. Now, cushions are placed around two sides and one end of the table in the shape of a U, like that. So here's cushions or mats around the table. Now, here's a round table, this illustration showing a little round table. Maybe this is King Arthur's Passover, I don't know. But again, you see it's a low eastern table, and the people are reclining. Now, don't confuse this with a Roman triclinium. You will read in commentaries that this is a Roman triclinium and Jesus is following Roman custom here. Not the case, you folks. A Roman triclinium is three separate couches. There's couch one, couch two, couch three. Three couches in the shape of a U. And one guest on each couch. And that's not what was happening in the upper room. So if you see that in a commentary, just take your pencil and, you know, white it out. Here's another model, a replica of a Roman triclinium. Again, notice it is three couches. This is not what is happening in the first century. This is what's happening in the first century. A low eastern table with all the disciples reclining around the table, just like this picture, down flat on the floor, on mats, on cushions. They're reclining with their left hand on their left arm. Their right hand is free to partake of the meal. And this reclining is symbolic of being a free man. And here's that round Passover table again. Here's the fellow reclining on his left hand. You see, a free man could afford the luxury of reclining at the meal. And we became a free and independent nation during the events of the Exodus. A slave, otherwise, had to stand or kneel or sit. The slaves had to be ready to obey their master at a moment's notice. And you see the two slaves here? They're not lying down. This guy on the right is bringing a Passover lamb, probably to another family's table. And on the left, you see another slave pouring wine. You see, they were not free men, but we became free men during the events of the Passover. So that's the importance of the reclining. All right, in groups of three or more, Jewish tradition follows this custom. The master of the group sits between the two most honored guests at the head of the table. So Jesus is the Rebbe, he's the master, he's sitting here at the head of the table. Notice it's at the side of the table, not at the end of the table like we do here in America. The most honored guest is above him to his left. That's where Judas will be sitting. The second most honored guest is below him to his right. That's where John will be reclining. And then, in descending order of importance, the rest of the disciples would be seated around the table. So we have the less important seats moving around the table in a clockwise direction until we get to the least important seat. The least important seat here at the foot of the table. And that's where Peter is reclining. He is in the least important seat at the foot of the table. Now, it could have been over these two seats that the disciples' spirit of competitiveness and rivalry and contention surfaced. Judas sitting in the most honored seat, Peter at the foot of the table. Now, we don't know exactly what happened, but let's turn to page 14 in your outline, labeled The Controversy. We don't know exactly why these men were sitting where they were sitting. We just can very easily deduce that that is where they are. Because I didn't have enough room on the slide. There is 12 on your diagram. Okay, there. All righty. Now, the strife is over who is going to be the greatest in the kingdom. And this is recorded in Luke 22, 24 through 30. Now, like Dr. Alfred Edersheim, I feel it's consistent with Judas's personality that he would claim and grab the left-hand seat, the seat of greatest honor. Now, here is our circular table again. This would be Papa, the most important, the head of the group, reclining here. Then to his left would be the most honored guest, probably his number one son, his firstborn. And then on his right, the second most honored position, probably his secondborn son. So the same pattern is followed here in this drawing. Now again, I feel it's consistent with Judas Iscariot's personality that he would claim the seat of greatest honor. And that aggressive claim could have easily triggered the controversy that occurred. Now, Jesus goes on and he rebukes this spirit of controversy, this spirit of competitiveness. And this is recorded again in Luke 22. And we'll get to that when we get to section 215. All right? The harmony is not organized correctly here. And I'll go through that in a little more detail with you in just a little bit. Now, John, who's often thought to be the youngest of the disciples, would be reclining to the right of Jesus in the second most honored position. This would put him in a position to ask the four ritual questions of the Passover Seder. And again, with his back to Jesus, this would have allowed him to lean back and put his head on Jesus' breast. And we'll see this very soon. So let's imagine Peter, stung by the master's rebuke, impulsively moving to the last seat, the seat at the foot of the table. And that would be consistent with his impulsive personality. Jesus rebukes them for competing over the most important seat, and he goes, okay, I'll take the last seat. I'll take the lowest seat. You know, that's Peter. But it's also possible, and I think it's a very strong possibility, that Jesus could have assigned the disciples their seat. You know, he could have said to Judas, you sit here. And he could have said to Peter, you sit over there. Now, Peter, of course, would have gone, all right, I'll take the lowest seat. But he would have done it. So I don't know. If Jesus had assigned their seats, that wouldn't account for the quarreling that occurred over who's the greatest. All right? But who knows? We'll have to ask Peter and Yeshua when we see them in the kingdom. One more irritation could have added to the controversy. And that was the fact that Jesus had asked for privacy. So there's no slave was present to wash the disciples' feet. And the disciples didn't want to humble themselves and do that job fit for a slave. Why? Because the feet are considered the most dishonorable part of the body. You know, the feet stepped in the dust and the dirt and the mud and the droppings and everything else that's in the street. The feet, even today, are considered the most dishonorable part of the body in the Middle East. And so with their attitude of pride, none of them humbled themselves to do this menial task fit for a slave. Rather, they were preoccupied with their thoughts of their own self-importance. That is, who is the greatest in the kingdom? Remember, Jesus just came into the city in the triumphal entry. The people heralded him. They called out, Baruch Abba B'Shem Adonai. He then went to the temple and he defeated the religious leaders and the political leaders. He just walked all over them. Hey, the kingdom's coming. We're here. He's going to institute it here in Jerusalem. We're going to get it, guys. We're going to be the leaders in the kingdom. Who's going to be the greatest? Well, me. See the attitude that they have? Their attitude is not a humble attitude. So, with this rather reverent beginning, Jesus is ready to begin his Passover. Here it is. This is the setup. This is the most significant Passover in the history of Israel. Now, turn to page 15. And as I said earlier, the harmony is well done. But the biggest flaw in the harmony is the order of the Passover. These guys really didn't know how to put it together. So, you see a chart on page 15 that puts the services in their correct order. Now, in our class, we are going to move through the Passover basically in the order found in the harmony. That's to try and minimize confusion, flipping back and forth and back and forth between the pages. So bear with me with that. But the correct order of the sections are found in the right-hand column of this chart. See the right-hand column where it says section number? Starts with 215, goes to 212, jumps to 217A. Goes to 213, jumps to 214A, okay? We're not going to go through it in that order because it would be too confusing. We will just go through it in the order that the harmony has put it together. So I hope that won't be as confusing to you as it could be. Alrighty, section 212, page 16, the beginning of the Passover meal. And it is now time for our nosh as well, as Jesus and his disciples get ready for their nosh, their meal. So let's go ahead and take our break, and we'll come back at section 212 and start moving through the Passover meal, the Last Supper itself. So go ahead and take your break. All right, we're underway again. We're now in section 212 as we start the Passover meal proper, the Last Supper of Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah. And so we'll start with the Luke account. Section 212 is on page 207 in your harmony. In the middle of the page, the beginning of the Passover meal. So let's read the Luke account, verses 14 through 16. That's in the right-hand column. Right-hand column. Everybody find that okay? And again, it's page 16 in your harmony. Or excuse me, in your outline. All right, verse 14. And when the hour had come, he reclined at the table, and the apostles with him. And he said to them, I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I say to you, I shall never again eat it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God. So Jesus has been personally looking forward to this particular Passover celebration. It'll be a very unique Passover celebration. It's special. It's the last one for Yeshua until. Until when? Until the Passover is celebrated in the Messianic Kingdom, in the Millennial Kingdom. Passover is one of the three festivals celebrated in the Millennial Kingdom. There may be more, but we know that Passover, Unleavened Bread, and the Feast of Tabernacles are all celebrated in the kingdom, as well as the Sabbath. The Sabbath will be observed and be mandatory for everybody in the kingdom as well. So he's looking forward to the Messianic Kingdom as well. Now note verse 15. Yeshua specifically states that he is celebrating Passover. Now I point this out because some commentators, in trying to reconcile Yeshua's statement about being in the grave 3 days and three nights, claim that he did not eat the actual Passover. They claim he had an anticipatory meal on Wednesday. Okay? However, verse 15 clearly states that he was eating the Passover. Now, I'll reconcile Yeshua's statement about 3 days and three nights and the book of John later on when we get there. But just for now, please note that this is unquestionably a Passover Seder. It's not an anticipatory one or anything like that. All right. Section 213, lesson 12, page 16 in the middle, the washing of the disciples' feet. Now, the first ceremony of the Passover is the drinking of the first cup, the cup of thanksgiving. And then, normally, you wash your hands. But what Jesus is going to do here is not normal. So let's read the John account. We're at the bottom of page 207. John covers this particular aspect of the Passover meal. We'll start with verses 1 through 5, bottom of page 207. Okay? Now, before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come and that he should depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Now, this is not a reference to Wednesday. This is a fact that his love for these men and for his own started long before this particular Passover Seder. But at this ceremony, we're going to see the full expression of God's love. We're going to see a tremendous expression of his love. So before the Feast of the Passover does not mean Wednesday. Look at verse 2. During the supper. All right, the Passover is underway. The first cup has been consumed. And we're at the second ceremony. During supper, the devil already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he came forth from God and was going back to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, and taking a towel, girded himself about. Page 208, top of the page. Then he poured water into the basin, and he began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. All right, here's what Yeshua does. Here's our seating order. Yeshua rises from his place at the head of the table, on the left-hand side there, and he moves over to the uncovered portion of the table. Perfectly normal. The other disciples expected him to do that. After all, how many seders had they been to? He was going to rise and wash his hands. But what Jesus does at this point is very unusual. He takes off his outer clothes. He pours water into a basin. He girds himself with a towel. And then he continues around the table. And guess who he comes to? The first person he comes to is Peter at the foot of the table. Now, Peter gets this figured out mighty quickly. All right? Verse 6. We'll now read verses 6 through 10. Peter doesn't want to see the Messiah, his master, do the work of a servant. He doesn't want Yeshua to degrade himself. Verse 6. And so he came to Simon Peter. He, Peter, said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" Jesus answered and said to him, "What I do you do not realize now, but you shall understand hereafter." Peter said to him, "Never shall you wash my feet. I'm not going to let you degrade yourself on my behalf. No way. You're not going to do it." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Well, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." "Well, if you're bound and determined to do it, do something honorable. Not just my feet, but my hands, my head, an honorable part of my body. Don't degrade yourself. Don't act like a slave." Jesus said to him, "He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you." All right, in those days, people didn't have bathrooms and bathtubs in their homes. Only the rich might have had that. And so public bathhouses were utilized. And so you went down to the public bathhouse before Passover or before Shabbat or something like that. But then the bather had to walk back home on dusty roads and dirty roads, etc., from the bathhouse. And so his feet stepped in all the garbage on the road, and when he got home, what would the servant do? The servant would wash his feet. And the feet were and are today considered the lowliest part of the body. And it's an insult to lift your shoe against somebody, for example. Remember President Bush in Iraq?
Yeah.
And what did that reporter do? He threw his shoe at him. What's he trying to do? He's trying to insult him with the maximum insult he can give him. And what did I read to you just a few minutes ago in our Israel news? What did the Palestinians in Bethlehem do? They shooed Obama's picture, President Obama's picture. They're insulting him as best they can. Okay? So to wash another's feet is the most menial, humble task possible. But Yeshua says, "You are clean all over." That's a reference to the bath that Peter took in the public bathhouse. So the lesson there is salvation. You know, in salvation we are bathed. We're totally cleansed. But guess what? We have to still walk around in this world, don't we? And what happens? Our feet get dirty. You know, we sin. We need to have our feet washed. And so needing to have our feet washed is a picture of our daily walk. It's a picture of our sanctification. We're totally cleansed when we're justified, but then we have to work at keeping our feet clean in sanctification. How do we keep our feet clean today, you guys? 1 John 1:9. If we confess our sins, He is faithful and righteous to forgive us our sins and what? Cleanse us from all unrighteousness. He'll wash our feet as much as we need it. And all we have to do is confess, "We got dirty, Father. We got dirty, Lord. We need to be cleansed." And it'll happen. And we'll be cleansed. So this I call the believer's wash rag. We confess, He cleanses us. Now point D on page 16 there. Jesus speaks of Judas's betrayal in verse 11 and verse 18. He knew exactly what was going to happen here. Verse 11. "For he knew the one who was betraying him. For this reason," he said, "not all of you are clean." So let's continue on through verses 12 through 20 and note verse 18 when we get to it. "And so when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and reclined at the table again, he said to them, 'Do you know what I have done for you?'" So now he returns to his place at the head of the table. Verse 13. "You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should do as I did to you. Truly I say to you, truly, truly I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, neither is the one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. I do not speak of all of you. I know the ones I have chosen, but it is that the scripture may be fulfilled, 'He who eats my bread has lifted up his heel against me.'" See, that's reference to Judas's betrayal. He knows what's going to happen. "From now on, I am telling you before it comes to pass. So when it does occur, you may believe that I am." In Notice the word he is in italics. That's not part of the text. He gives a little short-term prophecy here that they will witness being fulfilled in just a short time, and that will confirm that he is a prophet, that he is the God-man, that you may believe that I am. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who receives whomever I send receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. So believing in Yeshua is believing in the Father and receiving him. Now, through the foot washing, he repeated in graphic audiovisual terms two lessons. And these lessons were found in Matthew 20. We looked at them a while back. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you." That's the way the world operates. "But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave." That's lesson number one. If we want to be great in God's kingdom, we must be willing to become the servant of all. All right? Not the leader, the servant. And then he went on. Just as what? Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's the second lesson. This is why I came, as a servant. So we are to emulate our Messiah. Now, I'm going to leave a picture of dirty feet up there for you. And I have a reason for that. First of all, I want you, for your homework, to read the article on foot washing on page 17. But then we're going to read the bottom of the page of page 17, a personal experience. So you're all there? Okay. The bottom of page, a personal experience. All right, this came from a friend of mine named Anya. I met her at Camp Shoshana when I was teaching there one year with Ariel Ministries. She's a German girl that came over to Camp Shoshana. And then later on, she went on a mission trip to India. And so when she got back, I emailed her and said, "Anya, what was the greatest thing that happened to you in the mission trip?" And she replied from Stuttgart. And here's what she said. "Now, I may have trouble getting through this. I didn't do so well this morning. So be patient with me, okay?" All right. Here's Anya's letter, way back in December 2004. "If you ask me what the most impressive thing was for me there, what impacted me the most, then I would say the foot washing on Tuesday night." Oh, sorry guys, here it comes. I know it's coming. "The ministry's leader gave a teaching on the servanthood and humility of Jesus. And for the object lesson for the women, he had our team wash the feet of all our women in our small group. It was a very humbling experience, not only for the women, but for me as well." Page 18. "The cultural background is that the feet are considered the most unclean part of the body." That's in India too, as well as the Middle East. "You do not touch the feet, and especially not the sole of the foot." The women sat in the chair, heads covered, not looking at me, often crying. "As I knelt before them, washing their feet. Later, I found out that it was very humbling for them that a white person from a higher social and economic stand in life would serve them in such a way and do that for them." This is India. This is the caste system that still exists. They're the bottom of the rung. She, a white person, is the top of the rung. See what's happening here? The whole social order is being turned on its head. "The whole time I washed the feet of nearly 30 women, I thought, how lovely are the feet who bring good news. The The women walk in flip-flops and some barefoot here at the conference. And of course, at home in the villages, at home in their villages too, where the streets and paths are mostly dirt roads, and so the feet get very dirty. These feet walk through the mud and the dirt and whatever else you can think of. But they are carrying the gospel from door to door. They share sewing and literary skills. They teach the Bible to hundreds of women in their villages and beyond. They are prayer warriors, ministering to and serving other women and people around them. And it goes on and on. I did not see the dirt and the mud, but the beauty of these feet, how lovely they were. That's it, you guys, right there. Right there. That's the essence of all that the Lord taught. To be His servant and serve one another. These women are greatest in the kingdom. These humble women in India who don't have nothing. Some of them don't even have shoes. That's not God's point of view of them. His point of view is that they're greatest in the kingdom. All right, well, I made it through there. All right, washing one another's feet. Simple, humble servanthood. All right, let's go on to page 18 in the middle. We'll pick it up on section 214A, the identification of the betrayer. Now, I feel that Thomas and Gundry goofed a little bit at this point in the harmony. Therefore, I'm going to be dividing this section into two parts. Part A will be the karpas ceremony. Part B will be the Hillel sandwich or the korech. Now, Matthew, Mark, and Luke cover the first ceremony. John covers the second ceremony. So section 214 does not cover parallel accounts the way the harmony has laid it out. So let's start with the karpas ceremony and the meaning of the karpas ceremony. Now, this is the second prediction of Judas's betrayal. And only Matthew, Mark, and Luke cover this. Again, remember, the John account is not parallel. So what happens during karpas? A green vegetable, usually parsley, is dipped in salt water and eaten. Now, what's the meaning of this? Well, green is a symbol of springtime and of youthfulness. And the salt water represents the salt water of the Red Sea. So the meaning is this. When Israel was a young nation, in the springtime of our nationhood, God saved us by bringing us through, by using the salt water of the Red Sea. He brought us through the Red Sea to safety. So here is a picture of the karpas ceremony. There, parsley is being dipped in some Red Sea salt water there and eaten. And that's what you guys that attend the Passover will be doing next Tuesday. You'll be performing the karpas ceremony. All right, let's look at verse 18. The Mark account, chapter 14, verse 18, the identification of the betrayer. This is the center left column at the bottom of page 208. Center left column, verse 18. Everybody find that okay? Verse 18, and as they were reclining at the table and eating, Jesus said, truly I say to you that one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me. Now, some translations will use the word sat there. King James, American Standard Version, the New Living Bible, the New King James. But using the word sat gives the impression to 21st century Americans that you were sitting around at tables like we're doing here, right? The best translation is reclining, as the NASB or the NIV. That communicates more clearly what's happening. All right, now, page 19, top of the page, point 2. Judas is identified as the betrayer. Again, the first of two times. We'll pick this up in the Matthew account. The Matthew account is the far left column, starting on the bottom of page 208, verses 21 through 23. And as they were eating, He said, "Truly I say to you that one of you will betray me." And being deeply grieved, they, each one, began to say to him, "Surely not I, Lord." So there's a chorus of statements. "Surely not I, Lord. Surely not I, Lord. Surely not I, Lord." Everybody's making the same statement. And he answered and said, "He who dipped his hand with me in the bowl is the one who will betray me." So Jesus names no one, but he gives the clue. He dips the karpos. And apparently Judas dipped his karpos in the salt water the same time Jesus did. And so that would be the clue. Verses 24 and 25. Left-hand column, page 209. "The Son of Man is to go, just as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for him, for that man, if he had not been born." That's he's warning Judas. He knows exactly what's going to happen. He's telling Judas, "Don't do this. I know what's in store for you. The lowest depths of hell is in store for you." Verse 25, page 214. "And Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, 'Surely it is not I, Rabbi.' And he said to him, 'You have said it yourself.'" So Yeshua identifies Judas in a generic manner. Was he staring at him? I don't know what he was doing there. Now Judas is reclining next to him, right next to him. Judas probably whispered his response to Jesus. And Jesus identified the betrayer, but the rest of the disciples didn't understand. Okay? And he's pleading with Judas not to go through with this. The comment in verse 25, "You have said it yourself," is an idiom meaning, "Yes, it is you." We have a similar English idiom. "You said it, brother." It means yes, right? It's the same kind of thing. We give a positive answer. "You said it." Now remember, Peter had a knife. Probably the same knife he sacrificed that Passover lamb with. What do you think would have happened if he understood what Judas was about to do? Oh, yeah, he would have leapt across that table with a shout and slashed Judas to pieces. All right? He would try to prevent the betrayal. But that, if he had done that, it would have compromised prophecy. Matthew 26:15. Judas goes to the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me to betray him over to you?" And they weighed out 30 pieces of silver to him. "Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel." Judas's betrayal guarantees the crucifixion, which guarantees the resurrection. And that would have been short-circuited by Peter's passion if he had known exactly what Judas was going to do. All right, lesson 12, page 20 at the top. We come to the identification of the betrayer. This is the Koresh ceremony, the Hallel sandwich. This is the third prediction of Judas's betrayal. It's the John 13 account. So we'll pick up the Koresh ceremony here, the Hallel sandwich. So first of all, the meaning of the ceremony. What happens is that everybody at the Passover breaks off a piece of unleavened bread the size of an olive. That's the rabbinic minimum. And it's dipped into a mixture called charoset. Charoset is made up of apples, raisins, nuts, honey, cinnamon, wine, lemon rind, all chopped together. It's made at least 24 hours prior to the Seder. And after 24 hours, it turns deep brown in color. And therefore, it's the same color as the bricks and brick mortar we had to work with as slaves to Pharaoh. And so, because it looks like the bricks and brick mortar, it's a symbol of our slavery. It's a symbol of suffering. Now, the matzah is then dipped in the charoset, and then it's dipped in the horseradish, or the bitter herb, and then it's eaten. And the horseradish, or bitter herb, is a symbol of the bitterness of slavery. So again, here's a picture. Here's a piece of matzah being dipped in charoset. right there. And then this is I guess it's a mouth's eye view of a Hillel sandwich about to be consumed. Huh? And you make a little sandwich out of that. It's called the Hillel sandwich. Now the harosis tastes delicious. And so the full meaning is this: God's kindness made slavery bearable. Just as the harosis makes the maror, the bitter herb, the horseradish, bearable, so God's kindness made slavery bearable. Now, Yeshua did this 13 times. The master officiates and he dips the matzah for each person. And receiving the korech is a sign of love and affection and honor. Note that. All right, point two now, the korech during the last Passover. So now we're going to pick it up on the John account. This is page 208 in your harmony. So go back to 208. And the John account is in the far right column. And we'll read verses 21 and 22. So back on page 208, verse 21. John 13, 21. Everybody there? All right. When Jesus had said this, he became troubled in spirit and testified and said, "Truly, truly, I say to you that one of you will betray me." And the disciples began looking at one another at a loss to know of which one he was speaking. So the betrayer is identified again. He makes this public announcement, but no one is named. So they're very confused. Verse 23. There was reclining on Jesus' breast one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. Now, verse 23 is a reference to John, who was seated at the place of second greatest honor, the second most honored guest. So here's our table again, and here is John and Yeshua. Both of them are reclining on their left side. And since John, on the left here, is reclining on to Yeshua's right, he's reclining on Yeshua's breast. All he has to do is shift his weight and his head will rest on Yeshua's breast. Just that easy, right? Of course, right. All right, let's look at verse 24. Verse 24. Simon Peter therefore gestured to him and said to him, "Tell us who it is of whom he is speaking." So verse 24 now is a reference to Peter reclining at the foot of the table directly across from John. Directly across from John. Now, what does Peter do? He leans forward and he gestures, you know, something like that, to John. And he whispers this to him. Peter is intensely interested in who the betrayer is. So here's Peter leaning forward. What does John do? Well, John does the same thing. He just kind of leans forward. And Peter whispers this question to him privately, just across the table like that. The rest of the disciples don't hear it because where? They're at the other end of the table. Okay? They're not near them. All right, let's go to the top of page 21. And so the other disciples don't pick up on the remark. Okay? Now, Peter's motivation is to protect Jesus from the betrayal. Let's go to verse 25. He, John, leaning back thus on Jesus' breast, said to him, "Lord, who is it?" So what does John do next? Here's our seating situation. John just shifts his weight, and he leans back. And here is that illustration again. He just shifts his weight. He leans back against Jesus' breast. He just lifts his chin and whispers to Jesus. Verse 26. Jesus therefore answered, "That is the one for whom I shall dip the morsel and give it to him." So when he had dipped the morsel, he took it and gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. So what does Jesus do? Jesus just drops his chin and he whispers in John's ear and he quietly answers the question. So the clue is given, but Peter is not informed. Now, Judas is in the place of honor. So here Yeshua just takes his korech, his halal sandwich, and he just slips it over to John on his left. Just that simple. Or slips it over to Judas on his left. So Judas, in the place of honor, receives this token of love and affection and honor first. Let's read verses 27 through 30, first part of verse 30. Page 210, left-hand column, verse 27. And after the morsel, Satan then entered into him. Is the point of no return. This is the last appeal to Judas. I love you, Judas. Don't do this. And Judas steps over the line. The point of no return. Jesus therefore said to him, "What you do, do quickly." Now, no one of those reclining at the table knew for what purpose he said this to him. They don't get it. John is probably in shock. He's trying to process what he just saw. But nobody else has even a clue. For some were supposing, because Judas had the money box, that Jesus was saying to him, "Buy the things we have need of for the feast," or else that he should give something to the poor. And so after receiving the morsel, he went out immediately. And so he receives the halal sandwich, and people are stunned. They can't, John especially, our trusted treasurer. How could he betray Yeshua? You know, John is in a state of shock. He's trying to process this. And nobody suspects Judas. You know, he's the treasurer. We trust him more than anyone else. But Judas is forced to act at this point. Judas thinks he's being exposed. But the disciples in reality don't have a clue. Judas knew what was happening, but the others had no idea. So this action by Jesus will force Judas and the Sanhedrin to act on Passover night. They will act on the very night they do not want to act on. They will act on the very night they do not want to convene a religious trial. But who's in control? Yeshua is in control. He will die at the appointed time, the time appointed by prophecy. And then the last part of verse 30, the last phrase, "And it was night." Now this statement relates to John's sub-theme, the conflict between light and darkness. And to Jewish people, this statement seems, you know, irrelevant. Of course it was night. The Passover is always celebrated at night. It couldn't be anything else but night. You know, it's the evening, the beginning of the 15th of Nisan. The sun had set. Of course it was night. He's saying more than that. Jesus is saying more than that. He's describing the conflict between light and darkness. It is night, yes, but Judas is a man of the night. And he goes out into the night to do a deed of the night. The betrayal of Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God, who is the light of the world. All right, we have now run out of time for tonight. So we'll pick it up on Lesson 12, page 22, in 2 weeks after Passover. And I think Section 22 will have more meaning for you than ever before. So let's go ahead and close in prayer, and I'll turn you guys loose. Father, again, we want to thank you for your great love for us. You showed us the full extent of your love at the foot washing, where you came to serve us, even to the point of death upon the cross. You showed your great love for sinners in that you reached out to Judas, warning him what is in store for him for eternity. And he rejected that warning. Lord, thank you for your great love for everybody in this world and how you reach out to convict the world of sin and righteousness and judgment. But so few come to the light. So few. Most stay in the darkness. So Lord, help us to be your bright and shining lights in this world, that we might be part of your program of bringing those you have chosen out of darkness into light. And we thank you for allowing us to be part of this program. And we do so in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, we'll see you in 2 weeks.